Hi, and welcome to episode 3 of the Massage Matters podcast, part of the Physio Matters Network. I'm Becky DeMott Horton, a soft tissue therapist, and once again I'm joined by my partners in crime, Matt Scarsbrook and Anna Maria Mazzieri. Together, we created the Massage Collective to provide the link between traditional massage therapies and evidence-based practice in modern MSK care. As the Massage Collective, we want to provide resources to any therapists using manual techniques who wants to level up their understanding of what's going on underneath their hands and how massage fits within a contemporary biopsychosocial approach. The Massage Matters podcast is an opportunity to join us as we explore all aspects of massage and manual therapy, from modern concepts to delivering best practice advice that you can apply immediately in clinic. We'll be releasing new episodes fortnightly across all the usual platforms, so make sure you subscribe to stay up to date with the latest content. So by now, hopefully you've got your hands on a ticket to Therapy Live Sport on November the 7th. If by some miracle they haven't all been snatched up, then move quickly to get involved. We'll be there, cramming our heads with all the fantastic swim, bike, run, focus CPD. Really excitingly, we'll also be hosting a live Massage Matters podcast, exploring massage as a tool for recovery post-training and post-event. So for both some useful information on that subject, plus a chance to see the chaos that goes on when us three try and record a podcast, make sure you join us there. Right now, we've got some brand new content up on our Facebook page and YouTube channels, including videos introducing therapists to evidence-based practice, where to find evidence, and how to read research. So please go check those out and subscribe so you don't miss out on any updates. So on to today's episode, Practical Pain Science. There's been lots of talk out there for a while now regarding pain science, so this may be a subject you're very familiar with, or it might be entirely new to you. But our aim today is to think about the practical applications for us as manual therapists. Let's get stuck in. Matt, this is a subject close to your heart. Would you like to kick us off?
Absolutely, yeah. So I think probably the best thing to do is this isn't going to be a deep and meaningful about the pain science per se, but for anyone who's not familiar with pain science or the biopsychosocial model, I'm going to give a really, really quick overview. It's funny, one of the things we've talked about offline a couple of times is that sometimes I think we're guilty of coming across as if this is new stuff and that we're trying to pioneer something here, and the reality is quite different. Melzack and Wall came up with their pain gate theory in 1965. It was George Engle in 1977 who started talking about the fact that pain was related less to biomechanics. Initially, that was within a psychiatry setting. And it was in 1987 that Waddell really started talking about the biopsychosocial model in terms of lower back pain. And that's really where it opened the door for MSK therapies in general. So this is not new, but we're here really as much as anything else to make sure that people know where they can go for this information. So by all means, contact us after the podcast if there is anything that you need a little bit of direction for. However, for a quick overview, we've moved from the sort of the original Descartes model of pain being picked up by pain receptors at the point of a physical injury and being transmitted to the brain as a message of this is pain. Now to the understanding that pain is actually an experience. It's an output it's an output by the brain after the interpretation of multiple factors, sometimes including what is now called peripheral nociception. This danger signal being interpreted by nociceptors within the skin, for example, and being transmitted to the brain. And I think we're big fans of useful analogies on this show. And for me, a brilliant analogy that I use in my clients quite frequently when we get into kind of the nitty gritty of pain, if we're going that deep, is that it's sometimes better to consider pain similar to hunger. So hunger is a sensation that we're all pretty familiar with. But at the same time, none of us think we have hunger receptors. Instead, hunger is the complex sensation that comes from the fact that our tummy might be a little bit empty, the fact that it was a few hours since we had breakfast, the fact that someone just walked past with a fantastic smelling plate of chips or something. And all of that combines into this sensation that we interpret as hunger. But that hunger can be moderated, again, by outside influences. So you're in this state, you feel really hungry, and then someone walks by with something that to you smells absolutely revolting, and all of a sudden your hunger disappears. You know, you're no longer hungry, despite the fact that the other physical aspects of your lack of food still exist. You know, your blood sugar might be a bit low, and that's being picked up by the sensors in your periphery and translated by your brain, but all of a sudden you're no longer hungry. And so the analogy that I use is pain is similar to hunger in that it is a guide. It gives us some information, but it should probably not be taken as gospel at any time or another. We have to perhaps be able to take a step back and go, is it appropriate, this pain? Similar to, is it appropriate for me to be hungry? Or actually, if I hang on another 30 minutes, it'll be lunchtime and I can deal with it. So that's my kind of very, very brief overview of pain science, the BPS model, and a nice analogy that I've got. So Anna Maria, who's making funny faces at me, by the way, guys, over the chat that we're doing this at the moment. She's obviously in a good mood today. So Anna Maria, let's talk a bit more about massage therapy and how this pain science view leads into it.
Even without being aware, massage therapists use pain science, and actually, to be more precise, they use the biopsychosocial model within the practice, and they've been done so since they started, because the BPS model is telling us that the pain is, let's say, is a result of an interplay between the biomechanical, the psychosocial, the psychological, and the social emotional well-being of the person. And one of the things that, as massage therapists, we are very aware of and we tend to work with, it's about understanding that relation between stress, mood, how pain affects the person emotionally, psychologically, that actually we care about, we look after, we work with. If you think how many times the person with the shoulder pain came to your clinic and you've done your tests, your assessment, and the real healing sometimes happens on the couch when the person starts telling you about their they lost a husband quite recently, or how much the pain is making the person feel they're losing independence because they cannot do the meaningful activities that they used to do before. And for us, that being there, listening to them, validating that the feelings, validating the pain, validating those emotions is quite powerful in terms of the BPS model. What we have to do now, though, is to skillfully understand where to go with it. Is to skillfully understand how we respond to those cues. Skillfully understand how to guide the client to make understand themselves that the pain that came to us, the very biomechanical pain, they think it is a biomechanical pain, is actually a pain that it might be caused, or it might be influenced, not caused, maybe, sorry, that's not the correct term, might be influenced by the grief they're experiencing, the lack of self-efficacy they're experiencing. So from our perspective as massage therapists, while we provide the safe environment to remove the threat of to remove fears while we provide a relaxing environment to downregulate the stress response. We also must provide appropriate language to be consistent with that BPS model.
And where we fit, where I think we fit really nicely in with the what we know now about pain science is that time and that space that Anna was talking about there that we're able to give our clients. And we spoke about it before we started today. Something that you notice quite often in clinic is that somebody comes to you and they've been through various possibly avenues in primary and secondary care, and they've maybe had a couple of consultations with a GP or with a consultant or through imaging and so on, and they've been given lots of information about their pain or their condition, but they've never really had the chance to talk that through themselves and have the time with somebody who can put that in a real sense for them, so they can really make sense of what's going on and start to understand the complexities of pain. And I think that's where we can play a really important part.
Becky, you hit a really, really great point there. Actually, sometimes our values as therapists is the fact that we can support what, for example, we can put into context what the GP might have said, what they understood, what the GP have said, because the GP or the other healthcare professional might have said something. They go home and they interpret that with their understanding. And actually, when they come to us, we can really contextualize the understanding for them. And that's where our our place within a multidisciplinary environment is quite powerful.
And I think the fact that we're not a healthcare professional is sometimes actually really useful in that, allowing them in to explore that and talk it through, because you have, we all know, don't we? We sit in the doctor's office and we're a bit nervous and we don't feel on the same pegging as them sometimes, and it's difficult to ask the questions you want to ask and you don't always have the time. But actually being out of that healthcare environment and being in a nice room, in a pleasant setting with some nice music on maybe, and with someone that you know and trust, clients sometimes just explore that a little bit more and maybe ask the questions that they felt were stupid questions, or ask you to clarify it a little bit more because you're not that healthcare professional.
Yeah, I think this is where some of the soft skills that come in as well with soft tissue therapy, massage therapy, no pun intended there, but the soft skills in terms of around communication and some of the more maybe psychologically based sort of interventions. Not that we are psychologists, not that we're counselors, but talking about things like motivational interviewing, helping clients discover that sort of time and space to be able to work through these things themselves. I wonder if that's one of the reasons why, certainly in my experience, a lot of massage therapists come to the role as a second career later in life. Whilst there are, I'm sure, plenty of massage therapists who know that that's always what they've wanted to do and start off much younger than, say, I did. I started this in my 30s and as a second career, and I think almost everyone I was training with at the time was more or less at that kind of stage. Maybe they were returning from, you know, time off with children, or maybe they were looking at something in retirement, having done the same job for sort of, you know, their entire career. I think because of the soft skills that you develop through life, and I think because of some of the life experiences that you can then bring to your clinical practice when you are spending that amount of time with someone, particularly someone who is struggling with pain, and particularly because we now understand that pain is influenced by psychological and social contextual factors as well. I think having that background as a therapist, having some life experience as a therapist, is really, really powerful for the client.
And I think if we bring this back to how we apply pain science practically when we're in clinic, or you know, when we're working with clients, what that really says to me is that we have a massive responsibility, because we allow them this space and this time to talk, and that there's lots more going on than just the biomechanical when they come to see us for a massage. We have a real responsibility not to overload them with pain science, but make sure that they're understanding pain in the best way we can and to the best of our knowledge of pain at the moment.
That's exactly what you just said, it much more eloquently than I could ever do. But that's exactly my point when I said, when we are told about those cues from the clients, we need to know what to do with them. We need to understand and have the skills to be able to, I dread to use the word educate, although we call it pain education, because I find that sometimes using the term educate is quite patronizing. Mm-hmm. But what I think it could be useful is to make them aware, help them to discover by themselves that link. Because I find like, for example, during consultation, the classic consultation form, although my subjective assessment is quite extensive, I get people to fill in the form in advance. And there are some questionnaires taken from previous questionnaire, pain questionnaires, and I like them to fill them in advance, because I want them to actually spend the time to write down about the feelings, about the pain, and for them to think about elements that they might have not necessarily linked to the pain experience. But that's where we need to be skillful. We need to be skillful with the language we use, because the language can become nocivo. So language per se does harm if not used correctly. But also we need to know when to refer. Obviously we need to be good clinicians and know about red flags and be able to eliminate red flags. But there are other elements that not a red flag, but maybe a more deeper and deeper issues, psychological issues that we must be able to refer.
So slightly moving on from that, when we talk about, our responsibilities in the explanations that we give our clients and so on, we wanted to talk a little bit about moving away from, and this is a very practical thing we can do in clinic, moving away from the structural explanations that we tend to use and have previously been relied on. And I think this is already happening a lot. But again, it's something that we can do as massage therapists. And we've thought about this a bit between the three of us is, all three of us teach. And when we have students, they're very keen to find a structural explanation for somebody's pain. And they're very interested in doing things like postural analysis and how can we link that to pain. And we've kind of thought about why is that our comfort zone, if you like. And actually, I think it's really natural for us to, both as therapists and as clients, to want a structural explanation for what's going on. It's very simple. If I can say, my hip hurts because I have a knee valgus, I've got a nice clear explanation for my pain, and I've got a nice clear what can I do about it. But when you start to tell me that actually maybe it's because I'm not sleeping very well, or I'm very stressed with work, or, I have to sit here with Anna and record a podcast and that makes me stressed. pain starts to get very complex then. So I think it's okay. We need to give ourselves a break for having relied on these structural explanations, because that's where we feel safe, but we need to start pushing ourselves out of our comfort zone.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, for me, as well, perhaps just building on that, I see parallels here with, we end up talking psychology and mental health quite a lot between the three of us. And I see parallels here to experiences around mental health, and that people quite often when they're struggling, one of the reasons they're struggling is because no one else can see it. You know, you can't go round with a plaster cast on your head when you're suffering from severe anxiety, depression, schizophrenia. You know, people can't necessarily see and interpret it in the same way. And so in there does seem to be this draw from a society perspective to we need to have a physical problem to hang the hat on, you know, both as a practitioner, you want to be able to give the client a definitive answer. It feels good to be able to give them something they can work on. And as the client, everyone wants to know what's wrong with them.
Matt Law, in one of the webinars I did with Craig Levinson, Matt Law said something that just resonated with me. He said, as therapists, we are problem solvers. And as a problem solver, we'll find the problem even where the problem is not. Because we are patterned to find something wrong to fix. It's really, really important.
And I think that's where we need to be really skillful in our explanations to clients. And as Anna said, I'm a bit the same as Anna. I sort of balk at the word education, but we need to be clear in our explanations and help clients to understand that pain. Because I don't know about you, but how many times have you heard a client say to you, "Oh, I'm being sent for a scan. I really hope they find something because that means that my pain's real, or I've got an explanation for my pain." And what we need to be very skillful at doing is saying, well, yes, that scan might show something up, it might not. Whether it does or it doesn't isn't necessarily the explanation for your pain, but it also doesn't mean that your pain isn't real. Because, you know, as Anna's always very good at reminding us, pain is always real, however many factors are causing it. And it's, you know, we can help to get that across to the client and take away this kind of, oh, so you're telling me it's all in my head thing that we hear. And we can understand or explain that slightly more skillfully.
Yeah. And I think, again, that's where certain analogies come in. So one that obviously we've been working and chewing around a little bit to try and come up with a version of the analogy chewing around. Oh, did I just say chewing it over, chewing around? That's terrible. There we go. There's a
chewing Jack, out.
Jack,
no
that
chewing.
Was for you.
Yeah, sorry, Jack. So something that we've been mulling over. How about that? Is this idea that that pain is an alarm, and that, you know, we were trying to think of examples that we could really make fit well for us where we could say that pain is an alarm. And we've come up with a couple, essentially. And the first one is one that I've used previously with clients, which is if pain is like a car alarm, and your car alarm goes off in the middle of the night, you know, it wakes you up. From lying in bed, the car alarm going off, you can't tell if it was because a heavy wagon passed a bit too close to it on the road and gave it a bit of a rattle, or if someone's just walked along and keyed it, or someone's thrown a brick through the window. You know, these are three different, if you will, levels of input into the system. There was a bit of a shake, but nothing actually physically wrong. A bit of a light scratch in terms of the paintwork, although depending on your car, you might not review it as just a light scratch. And then a brick through the window, some clear damage that will need some repair. But the alarm is the same in each scenario. It sounds the same. It will go on for the same length of time. It's no different. So purely from the alarm itself, in this case, purely from the pain itself, we can't draw conclusions on the underlying physical condition of the tissues until we look further. And I think, Becky, you had one with a fire alarm.
Yeah, very similar, really. So my kind of default metaphor to use is that of a fire alarm, in exactly the same way that you use your car alarm at. You know, a fire alarm makes the same noise whether we've burnt the toast, which happens frequently in my house, or the house is burning down. And the other thing to sort of build on that metaphor, which I try and do with my clients a little bit, is until we know why that fire alarm's going off, we don't know what action we need to take. You know, it's making that noise. It makes the same noise for every event, whether it's it's the toast or the house burning down, but we don't know whether we need to just turn the toaster off or we need to get everybody out of the house. You know, and sometimes the fire alarm goes off because the battery's running a bit low or because there's a fault with the fire alarm. And it's, you know, so, but until we look into it, like you say, Matt, until we look into it a bit more, we don't really know what action we need to take just from that noise that the fire alarm's making.
I think as a society, we've learned to respond to the signals a little bit too quickly. We seem to become adverse to pain. We seem to be not wanting to be scared of pain. So you have a little bit of a discomfort and we take a painkiller so that we do not feel the pain anymore. I know that people might argue and say, oh, well, you know, I need to get on with my daily life and I want to feel at my best. Absolutely, but by doing so, by always being averse to pain and not accepting pain as part of normality, or some pain, sorry, as part of normality, we are lowering our vulnerability, we're lowering our threshold to it. Therefore, we are becoming quite fragile to it, which just makes me think, actually, at the concept of anti-fragility from Nassim Taleb. I know that he was an economist and he wrote the book as an economist, but it can be very well attributed to social healthcare. And what he says, I read it, anti-fragility is beyond resilience and robustness. Resilience resists shock and stay the same. The anti-fragile gets better. And the human body, indeed, the human mind, gets stronger, gets more resilient with chaos and with stress. We want to adapt and increase our capacity in our body, our capacity in our stress to become stronger, to become more resilient, to build up onto that. Again, there was a post ages ago that Mike James from Endurance Physio, love his post, but there was this particular one. He said, we need chaos in rehab, but not a chaotic plan. We need chaos in rehab. That really resonates with me because we want to expose our body and indeed our mind to gradual exposures to stresses, to differences, to chaos, to uncertainties, because only through that we are going to be able to accept those uncertainties, growing with them, and indeed becoming stronger out of them. And the same is with pain. If you have a persistent pain client, and we always try to do symptom modification to remove them from pain, what does by giving them maybe, you know, we give them a massage to remove them from pain so that the week after come in because they need the massage because you remove them from pain through the massage. What message is that communicating to them? That the only way for them to get out of pain is to receive a massage. But even worse is that the pain tolerance will become lower and lower. So as soon as they go a tiny little bit of pain, say, this is really bad, this is really bad. And they're going to try to find something to remove them from pain. Maybe should we adapt the nervous system to those stimuli, to those unpleasant feelings, so that they actually become then adapted to that and there is no more threat. And if there is no threat, maybe the pain experience will be changed. Becky, you wanted to...
Yeah, so you've sort of started to answer it, but I was going to put both you and Matt on the spot, really, and say if we're looking at this anti-fragility, keeping this as a practical thing, what then can we do as massage therapists to promote that in our clients?
Yes, I mentioned that already briefly, and gradual exposure. Gradual exposure of to an activity that they might like, but even if the activity creates a little bit of discomfort, just make them aware that if if they can give the pain a scale between 0 to 10, 10 being the most, 0 to be the least, just let them know that 0 to 3, 4, it's a safe zone. So even if they feel pain, they can continue that activity. 4 to 5, maybe, continue the movement. I'm a firm believer of continuing the movement, reducing the load, so that the movement is still the same. So they don't get afraid of the movement, but they keep the load a little bit lower. So gradually exposing them to an activity, but making them feel safe in that activity, because ultimately what gives a bigger experience of pain is fear. Fear, distress, anxiety, and depression. You remove the fear that they're doing something wrong that might damage the tissues even further. If the fear is removed, part of the pain experience will be diminished. So I would say, in every situation, expose them, make them feel safe. If somebody with osteoarthritis says, oh, I feel painful when I get up the chairs, maybe modify slightly, so put a little pillow, put a pillow on your chair, but actually continue with those exercises. Because although you're feeling pain, if the pain is solid 0 to 3 out of the scale of 10, there is no damage whatsoever. If the joint the day after feels okay, if there is no swelling, if there is no irritation for more than 24 hours, then it's very, very safe. It is okay to feel in pain, in discomfort. And also, this is the other thing. I try to also get my clients to understand the difference between pain and discomfort. So there is a different, you know, there is a difference intensity. Yes, Matt, what are you saying? Sorry, you're trying to get in.
You noticed. No, I suppose just to pick up on that gradual exposure, I do as well, and I suppose I do it through play, through a little bit of humor, through a little bit of fun. I have no issue playing the fool in clinic, in fact out of clinic, for anyone who knows me, but I suppose I sort of use play, and I try and make it fun, and I try and associate it back to activities that the client wants to do. But I do it in such a way. I was listening to a podcast the other day, so the Knowledge Exchange, which I actually have to thank one of my students for putting me onto, because somehow I'd missed that one.
Daniel
Carabella. And they were interviewing Back to Roots, a UK a couple of guys from the UK who specialize in kind of introducing this idea of play into rehab and things. And I was listening to them, and I was like, yeah, that is exactly the way that I love to approach it, is make it kind of enjoyable and use the element of lightness and of humor and of enjoyment to kind of offset any of the psychological concerns around, you know, the fear and the danger and the avoidance, particularly if you're comfortable enough to make a bit of a fool of yourself in front of the client. Because as this podcast alluded to, particularly as adults, we tend to feel foolish much more quickly, particularly when we're playing, when we're messing around. So I tend to do it first in order for the client to realize that they can't possibly look as stupid as I do. And that tends to distract them away from the fear around movement and the sort of the kinesiophobia that comes from that, and helps them rediscover that actually these movements are accessible, and that a range of different movement strategies are really important.
And adding to that, I think that's where, again, that communication with the client comes in, and understanding what movements are of value to them. And I think sometimes that's where some rehab falls down a little bit, because we tend to give clients exercises that we think works for a certain condition, but has no meaning to them. So if we can give them something that's got meaning in their life, I think they're a lot more willing to put up with a little bit of pain because their motivation is higher.
So that sort of brings us very nicely onto our regular feature, Theory to Practice, and discussing how this week we're able to take what we're talking about pain science and the biopsychosocial model and some of these other topics that we sort of wandered into, because actually they're all really, really relevant, and how actually can you now take this and start to try and apply it in clinic? Now, this is this particular sort of tidbit we've come up with is really close to my heart, because I am rubbish at it, and it's something that I really need to work on much harder. I'm very, very aware of it. So what we're talking about this week is silence. We're talking about being comfortable with allowing that silence between you and the client, so that you as the therapist don't feel you have to fill the airwaves. Because actually giving the client time to just think, to just be, to just exist, particularly when receiving treatment from you, if you're going for that sort of relaxing, fear-reducing massage approach, giving them that opportunity to think without you nattering on in the background, without having sort of, you know, chat radio on in the background, maybe just some nice music instead, means that you are more likely to draw out of them over the longer term more useful information about who they are, what they fear, what they love doing, what the pain means to them, what it would mean to them if they could go back to being pain-free, which gives you a huge amount of information to work with when then designing things like their treatment plans, when designing things like their rehabilitation.
Following on from that, a little bit of a task for you all this week, and we're going to check on with you on our Facebook Live on Wednesday to see how you got on. Try this little task. When the clients come in and you're going through the subjective and you're doing your questioning and they answer the questions, there will be moments of silence. We usually all want to jump in onto the silence and talk. At least I know that I do. But what you want to do, it might be awkward, but stop on the silence. Do not jump in. Because if you will not feel the silence, the client will with further information. And that is very, very powerful for the client. As I say, it's going to be a little bit awkward, and we have to kind of train ourselves not to feel the silence moments. But look at them, look at the client, and just be quiet and let them come in. So see how you get on with it.
And I feel like you're talking directly to me. So I will give this a go, and we'll absolutely bring it up on the Facebook Live on Wednesday. So moving on to our third point for the day then, is probably talking around communication of pain science in particular with our clients.
And I think it's actually sort of follows on quite well from that theory to practice as well. I think something I've been really guilty of in the past, and I think a lot of us have, is overwhelming our clients with our pain science, because I'm so excited by it and I find it all fascinating that actually I forget sometimes that our clients just want a clear and easy understandable explanation, and they don't want to hear the work of everybody who's ever worked in pain science. So I think it's a really difficult balance, but finding a way to explain a very complex subject matter in a way that's relevant to them and that they can understand and they can make sense of without massively overloading them with tons of information, I think is a really fine tightrope to walk.
It's something I've definitely been guilty of to begin with. You know, you kind of come out of lectures or CPD where you've learned something new, or hell, even off podcasts, and you're like, this is amazing, this clears up a lot for me, I bet it would do wonders for my clients, and end up telling them everything and not necessarily considering, were they ready for it? Are they in a position where they can take this information on board and it's meaningful? Are you risking driving a wedge between you and your client, because that's just not the page they're on right now? And because fundamentally at the end of the day, it doesn't matter what the explanation is, it still hurts.
Absolutely spot on, Matt. Actually, we all did that. I did that years ago, and I wish I could call all my clients back and say, I'm sorry to have overloaded you. But that's where I think as massage therapists, we have a little bit more of a, how do you say in this country, you have an extra...
I don't know.
Yeah, neither do I. There was something that I wanted to say, but we are luckier in terms of we have this the opportunity to spend the 45 minutes or so with our clients while we're massaging them. So the client is very relaxed. So we have therapeutic alliance already established, and they're very, very receptive. But also, when you said something quite powerful, you said about alienating a client, you're absolutely right. Ultimately, our clients come through our door because possibly outside, most of us has written massage therapy. So we might go to a course that completely changes our perception of healthcare. All of a sudden, we realize that we need to change practice, and that is very, very good. But before doing so with our clients, we have to prepare our clients. We have to make them understand that they came last week and they had a treatment, and the time that they come next month, I cannot change completely because it will not be fulfilling their expectations. So we have to kind of be kind to them and explain that maybe what we did so far might have had benefits. However, the benefits that he had, we explained them in ways that now we know is not possible anymore. We just got to rephrase, and we have to be very, very careful because it's not about them. It should be client-centered. So it's not about them. And what sometimes I find that my client's expectations have to be taken into consideration as much as my skills, as much as the evidence there. So if the client is expecting or if the client benefits from receiving a massage, I cannot spend the whole hour explaining pain science because I want to show the case what I learned.
That's a really great point, Anna, actually. And we have to remember that it might not just be their past experience of treatments with us that we need to be cautious around how we change, but also what expectations they come in with from other areas of society. And I see it an awful lot. I work quite a lot with runners, and it's a classic that a runner gets some knee pain or something and they speak to everybody in the running club and they all go, oh yeah, yeah, it's this, and they give them a very biomechanical explanation that they might have heard or they may have read in a magazine or something. And when they come in and they come with those preconceived ideas of what's causing their pain, I think we need to be quite kind and quite gentle in how we maybe steer them away from that biomechanical explanation if that's what's required, because we don't want to make them feel stupid for accepting that explanation. And we don't want to, like you say, alienate them, because it's a difficult concept to understand. So I just think we need to be gentle and maybe not quite as bull in a china shop as I have been in the past, because it excites me so much.
That was a great chat, big topic, and out of the big topic, which we could have gone on talking about it forever, there are three main points we kind of discussed and we wanted to share with you. We want to all think about it. One is that as massage therapists, you're already probably working within a biopsychosocial model of care. You might until now thought that you were looking after the body only, the biomechanical part of it. But if you look at your subjective, if you look at your discussions with the client on the couch, if you look at probably your home care advice, you probably find that you are very well placed as a professional to treat the person within the biopsychosocial framework. The second and more important one, if pain science has taught us something, is that we should reduce structuralism. We should reduce the way we see a client in pain. We should reduce the, we should change the way we explain the pain of the client. We need to make the client understand, making them aware that that pain is more than just a tissue, in more than just a structure, that the pain is an experience. So let's start treating the person and not the pain that the person is coming to us with. And last, which they are all very linked, is communication. How we do that? We must use the right terminology. As professionals, we must do no harm. And actually, with language, we can do harm. We can make somebody very fragile. And while we want to create anti-fragility in somebody, and that is about giving them self-efficacy through educating them, through raising awareness, and through possibly sharing with them experiences, sharing with them metaphors, try to see the way they learn and change your language to support them to learn through their way they learn and understand. So thank you very much for following us, and we will catch up a little bit on what we discussed today this coming Wednesday on our Facebook Live to see how you all got on this week, and looking forward to next time.
So that's it from us for today. As ever, next podcast will be out in 2 weeks' time, and we hope you can all join us then. In the meantime, feel free to join in the conversation at the Massage Collective on Facebook or get in touch via massage@physio-matters.com. And remember to make sure the 7th of November is in your diaries for Therapy Live Sport. Definitely not one to be missed. And we'll see you next time.